You're with us as we talk about the cheese industry on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Glad you could be with us this morning. Wisconsin has continued its dominance in the cheese industry amid the pandemic. We were the leading cheese-producing state in May, producing almost 281 million pounds. That's down, though, 1.8% year over year for May. Have you noticed the fluctuations in cheese prices at the grocery store? Have you been stocking up on cheese? We're making more comfort foods like mac and cheese and pizza last night. Are you? We're at 800-642-1234. John Umhafer is Executive Director of the Wisconsin Cheesemakers Association. John, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning.
Well, good morning. Let's start with cheddar. So the wholesale price of cheddar reached record highs last month, and then that was just a few weeks after falling to 20-year lows. Can you give us a sense of the volatility there and what the cheese market is normally like?
Well, it's been unprecedented. We're on a roller coaster like we've never seen. It's not unusual for the cheese price to move a penny or two and make news in our industry. But in the last few months, we've gone from the wholesale price that the industry uses, reached $1 for a pound of cheddar. And that has rocketed up to $2.81 just a few weeks ago, like you said, and now has settled back to $2.70 a pound at wholesale. So from $1 to $2.70 is quite the roller coaster for the industry.
What is going on?
Well, this is completely related to the COVID-19 situation. When restaurants abruptly closed and schools and theme parks and baseball parks and the entire food service side of the business closed back in March and April, the bottom fell out of the market. About half the cheese America eats happens in these food service type of locations. And suddenly, within days, that market disappeared. And so the price just plummeted. There was far too much cheese around in America at that point.
What has brought the wholesale price back up?
Well, there was a number of factors that hit simultaneously. One, and probably the biggest, is that about a month ago, restaurants and the distributors to those restaurants realized that the openings were going to start to happen, and they ordered furiously to refill coolers in the restaurant industry. And suddenly, people who hadn't ordered in a while were calling up saying they needed truckloads and many truckloads of cheese from all our makers. At the same time, people are buying more cheese in the grocery store in the last few months. People are cooking at home. And even now, cheese sales are up. Just in the latest data we have is June. It's lagging a bit. But in the week of June 14th, people were still buying 12% more cheese in the grocery store than they had the year before. So overall this year, cheese sales are up 16% at the grocery store. So you've got the food service coming back. You've got retail up. And then even exports rose when the price got low. The world bought our cheese when it went down to $1.
So the market,
all those factors combined.
Yeah, the market really doesn't do well when you have these rigid stop and starts with demand.
Right, you don't see this sort of stop and start. You've never seen virtually the entire food service industry say we don't need cheese for the foreseeable future. It's never happened before.
We're looking at the cheese market, the industry, with John Umhafer. He's Executive Director of the Wisconsin Cheesemakers Association. Have you noticed the fluctuations in cheese prices? Have you been stocking up on cheese or even just buying a little more than you usually would? Are you a dairy farmer or cheesemaker? How has the pandemic affected your business? We're at 800-642-1234. John, what do these fluctuations mean for the prices we're seeing at the grocery store as consumers?
Well, there's always a lag, and we're hoping that we'll see prices normalize at some point here so that it doesn't necessarily take the retail price up too far. The grocery industry tries to take the highs and lows out of the market to keep the consumer, you know, buying. But definitely, I think once you've got prices that have lingered now for several weeks at record highs at $2.70 now at the wholesale, that will translate into the grocery store, without a doubt. And generally, there is a reaction to that. The high cost usually does tamp down demand. We haven't seen it in the numbers yet, though. So it's interesting that consumers are really turned to some comfort foods, I think. And cheddar cheese is one of them. It's up 15% itself. Mozzarella is up 23% over last year in sales at the grocery store. So people are cooking at home, and we haven't seen that price necessarily knock down demand yet.
Is cheddar a good bellwether for what the rest of the cheese industry might be experiencing?
I think it is, although really you look at that, the mozzarella is another key product. But in our industry, we use cheddar as the base price for even the milk that the dairy farmer is paid for. It's considered kind of the key basic product. And it's the one that's made by companies, especially in this pandemic, that needed to store cheese for a while. Cheddar is, of course, ageable. And so when we had too much product a few months ago, everyone turned to making cheddars because they knew they could store it and sell it as aged cheddar if they needed to for the long haul.
I wonder if that spike in mozzarella could be all the pizza that we're consuming?
I think it is. We found on the bright side that the pizzeria industry, and we heard this from a lot of our members, that not only the big chains are actually up in sales, but the small local pizzerias really grabbed onto those opportunities like the Grubhubs and the Dine and Dashes to learn how to become a total marketer of their product. And a lot of those have done well, and we hope survive that for the long haul because they've learn to be a takeout or a delivery service more than they had been before.
As you mentioned there, cheese normally isn't a shelf-stable product, and grocery stores have stayed open during the pandemic. Do you think the higher demand from consumers will continue?
Well, it's interesting. We watched that number changing through time. When the first rush of people hit the grocery store, cheese sales were up about 75% over the week before.
Wow.
everyone bought everything at the grocery store. That settled into the 30%, and now we're in the teens. So we definitely see people, I think, getting back to a mix of getting takeout food or maybe venturing out in states where they can to restaurants. So now we're at 12% more cheese sales than the same week a year before, and that's June data. So we still see people buying more at home, but we think that they're going back to ordering out.
I was looking at May data, and Wisconsin still leads the nation in the amount of cheese produced. Do we stay pretty steadily on top?
Oh yes, yes. You know, many years ago, back in the 80s, California surpassed Wisconsin in the amount of milk produced at the farm. So we never lost the cheese crown that we've had for about 100 years. So we are still the cheese state, without a doubt. And we've got quite a lead in that. And that's due in part to, you know, an industry that's kept growing and really diversified into specialty cheese. And that's really our niche. We've got half the specialty cheeses are made in the United States are made in Wisconsin. And I'm happy to say we've been talking with members and those makers, those smaller makers, those artisans, are hanging in there and in some cases doing well at the grocery store. So we see the industry not necessarily taking too big a hit on the specialty side.
We're sizing up the cheese industry, taking stock with John Umhafer as our guide. He heads up the state's Cheesemakers Association. Are you a dairy farmer, maybe an artisan cheesemaker? How has the pandemic affected your business, your livelihood, without the usual demand? What are your questions about the cheese market and where it's headed? Be part of this at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with more on cheese here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the cheese industry, the market for cheese here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Hundreds of dairy farms have shut down this year, and the industry has faced a record number of bankruptcies in recent years. Volatile prices and overproduction are hitting the cheese industry amid the pandemic. Have you seen the ups and downs of cheese prices in recent months? Is your grocery store selling your favorite cheeses? Do you buy directly from a creamery? How are they doing? Join in at 800-642-1234. John Umhafer is executive director of the Wisconsin Cheesemakers Association, and he stays with us. So, Jen, we were talking there about artisan cheesemakers. It reminds me that we talked with Uplands Cheese in Dodgeville last month. Andy Hatch and his crew there make the Pleasant Ridge Reserve and the Rush Creek Reserve. So if you're a farmstead cheesemaker like Andy, you use the milk from the cows on your farm and you make the cheese there, does that help you have any more control in these volatile times?
I think it definitely does. The concern for the very smallest, to like Andy, who makes amazing cheese, is those outlets that he has to sell to, and that is farmers markets, which have come back to some extent, and then the sit-down retail outlets, the sit-down restaurants. So there's a concern that, you know, right now in America, at least 50% of the capacity of the sit-down restaurants is still closed. So those high-end cheeses where you actually see them on the menu because they're so special, a lot of those opportunities are gone. So we are worried for and trying to help our artisan members. But at retail, they seem to be doing quite well. So I believe Andy's probably doing well at retail.
Are artisan cheesemakers able to contract, make less cheese, and then expand when they have more demand? Or are their operations pretty set?
Well, it does vary. I think Andy uses all his milk for cheese making. Others use a portion of their milk and do sell the rest to, say, a milk bottling plant. So they have some flexibility. And others purchase their milk from neighbors. So I think, again, there's some flexibility there. So it depends on the maker. But the main concern is whether they can find that end market. And for the most part, we're hearing that they are going to survive these unusual times.
How important is it maybe to find the cheese you like and then trace it, find where it's made and buy directly from the cheesemaker?
Well, we think that's crucial now, especially for those artisans. And I was looking last night if people would visit Dairy Farmers of Wisconsin, their website. They've got a great listing that simply takes you to the websites to all the artisans in the state. So we'd love to see people go there and support these folks that are making the cheese that kind of puts Wisconsin on the map.
Help us connect dairy farmers with this process, because dairy has been through so many bankruptcies leading the nation. How has the dairy market and the volatility there affected what you're seeing happening with cheese?
Well, there's a direct connection. Not only is demand up right now, which has taken the cheese market up, but in May, dairy farmers actually contracted the amount of milk that they make. It was down 1.1%. And generally speaking, milk production has been slowly rising across the United States for several years. You might see a 1 or 2% gain in a month. So farmers did react properly, I think, to the real plummet we had in milk prices earlier in this spring. But on that same roller coaster, prices went way down, and now they're way up. So in June, we had a $21 Class 3 milk price, which in an industry where typical might be $16 for every 100 pounds of milk, it was $21. And the farmers this month should be getting a check from the federal government, which was a sort of emergency bailout, given the fact that prices had plummeted all the way down to $12. So they've gone on this roller coaster from $12 a hundredweight in May to what should be $27 in June. It's just incredible.
Will cheesemakers have the same ability to get resources through the CARES Act and other funding that has been trying to help small businesses?
Yeah, there's been some bright spots. Of course, there was the opportunities that all businesses had with the PPP money that was used to keep their employees in place. But also USDA came out with a rather innovative program called the Food Box Program, which is meat and vegetable producers and dairy producers literally putting products in boxes that they give to food pantries and food banks around the country that are ready for the consumer. That box goes right into the consumer's car. So there's been about $3 billion in purchases by USDA to fill boxes like that. And many of our cheesemakers in Wisconsin have been filling orders where they're sending pounds of cheddar, pounds of Monterey Jack, and so forth, pounds of mozzarella that fill these food boxes. And the great thing is that helps the dairy farmer, and it's going right to families that need help right now getting food on the table.
We're learning how the cheese market is faring during these turbulent economic times with John Umhafer. He heads up the Wisconsin Cheesemakers Association. You can join in. What are your questions about the cheese market? Are you a dairy farmer or cheesemaker? How is the pandemic impacting your operations, and where is it headed next? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Tom now, joining us from Sparta. Hi, Tom.
Hi, good morning. It sure would be nice if there was a traded market or an established price for some of the high-end dairy proteins like whey protein concentrate 80 or whey protein isolate. And then second, it seems like we need one professional dairy association in Wisconsin, not two. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. John, can you address number one with whey protein?
Sure. Actually, whey protein has really been a star in the dairy industry, and what Tom was referring to is the industry's gone from whey being something that back, 100 years ago was offered to the pigs on the farm to something that they've discovered these short-chain proteins in whey are highly digestible. They are highly useful to the body for muscle building, and of course, you go to a GNC store now and you see the whey on the shelves. And that's that high-end, very distilled whey protein. And right, the market now that's offered is a commodity market at 34% for whey. And he's talking about the higher-end products that could also be traded. They base the price for the high-end products now on the low-end products at a premium.
How do the commodity markets work around these cheeses and something like whey?
Well, it's interesting. There's a lot of cheddar in the United States right now that was made this spring, but the market in Chicago that trades everything from oil to cocoa
grains
to cheddar, yep, grains, those classic Chicago markets, also trades young cheddar cheese. So the whole market that dairy farmers receive a price for, cheesemakers receive a price for, is all based on young cheddar that's traded down at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
And what is that trading like? Is it digital? Is it on a floor? Do you follow it on a ticker?
It is a 10-minute digital anonymous market down in Chicago where people buy and sell cheese by the truckload. So that is where you learn if there's too much cheese in the United States and people are coming to the market with truckloads, or if people are moving away from the market and you see the market price not change. So there's been a lot of sales this spring that have bounced that price to record levels.
Yeah, are there some types of cheeses that are more prone to price instability?
Well, we did find that some cheeses are more prone to instability in the end channel more than a price difference. And that was, we found that makers of, say, blue cheese and feta, if not just the seasonality, people do tend to eat feta cheese, for example, more in the summer. We also found that they tend to be served more at restaurants. So some of those manufacturers were having a difficult spring. Similarly for Parmesan, that is a price-sensitive cheese. It's an expensive cheese because it's one of the most difficult to make, and it has to age for 2 years. So there are different cheeses that have different sensitivities to a market. And when the market does crazy things like it did this spring, some of our makers definitely were hurting.
John, are new cheesemakers getting into the market? Do you see signs that this is a growing industry?
It definitely has had a great run in the last, say, 20 years where we've had artisans come in, people giving cheese a try, and some having great success. I'd say Upland's cheese, as you mentioned earlier, is one of the great stories of an industry where someone came in with a new idea, a new cheese idea, and it has become one of the most famous cheeses in the United States. Up north, you've got Marika Gouda, Marika Penterman, starting to make a real Holland-style Gouda, and that taking off to great effect. So we love to see that in the industry. That's really what puts Wisconsin on the map as the place to go for innovative cheesemakers.
And there's still room for that creativity and that innovation in cheesemaking.
Oh, I definitely think so. There's product that still has never been seen on these shores. If you travel in Europe, travel around the world, that our cheesemakers now do such a magnificent job of inventing, you know, new cheeses for America, but also finding cheeses around the world and bringing them to the United States.
John, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you.
John Umhafer is Executive Director of the Wisconsin Cheesemakers Association. Coming up, a biohazard expert explains what her work entails and what it takes to sanitize in the time of a pandemic. We go on a tour of disinfecting and deep cleaning after confirmed or suspected coronavirus cases. That's after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. The CDC has guidelines on cleaning and disinfecting rooms or areas occupied by people with suspected or confirmed COVID-19. We're talking with a biohazard expert here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says it's unknown how long the air inside a room occupied by someone with confirmed COVID-19 remains potentially infectious. Facilities will need to consider factors like the size of the room and the ventilation system design, and then there are the surfaces. Do you work for a cleaning company? What is it like to deep clean and sanitize during the pandemic? Do you have enough PPE? We're at 800-642-1234. Carol Shabbat is a biohazard expert, owner of SteraClean, which operates out of the Maryland-Delaware area. Carol, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Thank you for having me.
All right. So take us back pre-pandemic, before all of this took place. What was your company working on? What were the types of jobs?
Yeah, our portfolio and the jobs we worked were hoarding remediation, crime scene cleanup, decomposition site cleanup, disinfection and deodorizing against other viruses like C. diff and, rodent dropping cleanups, believe it or not. So that was primarily what we were focused on pre-pandemic.
Are you out there doing these cleanups for these customers?
We are, absolutely. I like to say it as simply as this: if no one else will clean it, we will. So we get into all types of different scenarios. If somebody is just reluctant to do it themselves and they just need help, luckily they find us, they call us, and we will be happy to help them out.
So when did the calls start coming in from customers looking for cleaning up from coronavirus?
Yeah, good question. I would say the first call I got was right at the beginning of March. And the first call I got was an embassy in Washington, D.C. And the gentleman was just, it was a facilities manager, and he was just really, really concerned. He made the right call because he had questions. He didn't know what he was facing. The building was about 750,000 square feet, so we had a lot of space to consider, and we just talked through it. And fortunately, we got, in the beginning of March, a lot of calls from people like that just preparing and trying to learn and educate themselves on what was to come and how to handle it. So the calls started right away.
And when you're talking through the situation with this prospective customer, what is that conversation like? What are you hitting on?
Yeah, it was actually a wonderful conversation because we were sort of both in the same boat of so many unknowns. So we just walked through it together And I think in a lot of ways in life, common sense just has to prevail. So we walked through it, and I basically just mentioned, it's like, look, we can do this. We disinfect, we deodorize, we clean, we can handle this. But the first thing I would do if I were him was try to figure out how to not let it get into the building. So he and I talked. It's like, maybe you need to have secure doors for employees, section employees off in areas that they stay in and they don't wander anymore, or cleaning stations and things like that. And then just putting him at ease as far as, you know, he has 750,000 square feet, but that doesn't mean everything needs cleaned. In other words, atrium glass at the ceiling height, you don't need to clean that, but high touch point areas, entryways, sink faucets, toilet handles, things like that. That's what he needed to concentrate on. So it was a very fluid, very flexible conversation, and I think I gave him some peace of mind.
How would you compare crime scene cleanup to cleaning now, deep cleaning during the pandemic?
You know, we approach it basically the same way. And we have to approach almost any job, whether it's crime scene, COVID, even a hoarding job. We have to approach it the same way, which is, we don't know. We don't know what all is inside. We don't know what we're going to uncover. We don't know what the condition of the areas are, or the homes or the businesses, whatever we're walking into. So we really, it's not that much further out from what we are trained to do, what we have been doing, and how we handle things because of the unknowns. A lot of people say, well, you know, how do you know if you're doing a hoarding job, there's not COVID? That's a great question, because we don't, because some people don't even know they have COVID. So we just approach it with safety in mind first. Precautions with the team, you know, protecting ourselves with PPE, masks, gloves, boot covers, goggles, whatever we need to protect ourselves with. And then we just approach it with, you know, we don't know, so we just have to be careful and pay due diligence to what we're doing.
How has your access been to the protective equipment, the PPE? Do you have what you need in order to do these jobs?
Yeah, that's a great question, too. I was fortunate in the beginning of all of this that I had a pretty good supply on hand. However, we did get a call for a major government organization in D.C. with almost 1 million square feet of cleaning space. So I did have to order more. And unfortunately, it was at the time where everything was sort of being gobbled up by everyone. So I had to go to Japan for respirator filters. I had a back order on supplies as far as the PPE suits, but I was able to get suits relatively quickly. And I would say the biggest thing was the equipment, especially the electrostatic sprayers. Again, fortunately, I had some, but I was looking to get more. And not only could I not get electrostatic sprayers, but if there were some available, the prices were so inflated. It was ridiculous.
So what are what are these electrostatic sprayers? What do they do?
Yeah, that seems to be the thing that everybody is gravitating to in order to clean and disinfect against COVID. And basically what it is, it's a spray mechanism, a gun, if you will, that electrifies the molecules of the chemical. So instead of the chemical just hitting a surface flat, the electrostatic element to the mechanism it wraps around whatever it hits. So it's a 360 degree sort of capture instead of just a topical flat surface capture from the chemicals. So it's very effective and it is a very good tool. But again, in order to get one now, I would be paying probably 4 times, 5 times, maybe 6 times what the normal price would be.
We're talking with Carol Shabbat, who is a biohazard expert, owns a cleaning business on the East Coast, and her company focuses on cleaning up hoarding environments, as she's described crime scenes, now disinfecting during the pandemic. You can join in with your questions about deep cleaning, 800-642-1234. We heard from Louise in Wauwatosa, called in this morning, and Louise says their carpeting is dirty from Wisconsin's winter, from dog accidents and all that stuff. Louise wants to know, is it safe to have the carpet professionally cleaned amid the coronavirus pandemic?
Absolutely. I would tell Louise, ask whoever she is engaging to clean her carpets, whether or not they are following the protocol of the government, the local government, state government, federal government, which is simply, you know, are their workers protecting themselves and her with masks and PPE? And if they're following those protocols, absolutely, it would be safe to allow someone in and clean those carpets.
In May, you and a pair of technicians worked on the home of a person who had passed away from the coronavirus. Can you walk us through the process of what you needed to do in order to disinfect that home?
Yeah, absolutely. The client who called was the daughter of the homeowner. And unfortunately, the homeowner passed away. And the daughter made the right call as far as not entering the home to secure, obviously, the things she needed to secure, and then begin the process of settling the estate because she did pass from COVID. So she called us to disinfect the home so she could do, all the things she needed to do with her mom's passing. So the first thing we do is what I do is I just interview the client as far as habits and how her mom lived in her home and, you know, what she liked to do. In other words, this lady liked to knit. And I know that sounds sort of obscure, but it'll make sense as I go through here. But just an interview as far as the client, the homeowner, habits, things like that. And then once we got into the home, again, the vital points to address and focus on are high touch points. So, again, doorknobs, sink faucets, refrigerator handles. But like I said, this lady liked to knit. So I needed to decide whether or not I could clean and disinfect and deodorize all her knitting material, her bag and her needles and all of that. And we made the decision then to also just discard the yarn because it's very hard to clean something like that. And since it was just yarn, we just decided to be overly safe and cautious. And we just discarded that. But what we do more importantly than probably anything is we really do try and put ourselves in that person's world. So we'll look and we'll see how this lady lived. So she sat in one chair and she had all her remotes at the side table and there was a lamp there. So if you're
walking in their footsteps, right? We have to pause there with Carol Shabbat, a biohazard expert, learning about deep cleaning and sanitizing amid the pandemic. With your questions, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The coronavirus can live on hard surfaces like plastic and stainless steel for up to 3 days. That's from Harvard Medical School. It can be contracted by touching an infected surface, then touching your mouth or nose, making cleaning of surfaces important. What are you doing to keep your living space clean? Has your cleaning routine changed? Do you trust disinfectant solutions? What about bleach? Join in 800-642-1234. Carol Shabbat owns a company that cleans up hoarding situations, crime scenes, and now facilities needing disinfection due to the pandemic, and she stays with us. Carol, take us back into the home that you disinfected after the person had passed away and really understanding how you have to walk in their footsteps to understand what is the priority for cleaning and what can you let go of?
Right. And you put it better than I did. We do walk in their footsteps. what we try and do is just think beyond maybe the obvious. So in other words, in that situation, we emptied all the waste baskets, because if you think about it, this lady was sick, so she was using tissues. Well, again, even though we have some guidelines and we have some statements from the scientists and everyone as far as how long this does live, we don't know for sure. So we emptied all her waste baskets just to make sure we're getting all of those things that we know that she used in order to, fight the illness that she was fighting. But really, we just do a triple check. We first clean, which is very important. We don't just spray a disinfectant. We do clean, because there is this thing out there that is, we call a biofilm. A biofilm is just basically film from grease or your oils in your skin that if you touch something, it transfers. And then that film attracts everything, dust, viruses, bacteria. So it's most important that you clean first. Clean the biofilm up that has everything attracted to it, and then you go back and you disinfect and sanitize the surfaces and the areas that we're working. So that's our protocol.
Well, untangle that cleaning and disinfecting, and when we should incorporate bleach and how we should use that. Help us understand these products.
Mm-hmm. The first thing I would tell people is if you're cleaning on your own, please read the directions of the product you're using and follow the manufacturer guidelines. I know before I started this business, I never read a bottle of cleaner. I never read it. I squirt it. I cleaned. That was it. But the key to this is each chemical or each cleaner that is on the market has different protocols as far as how to use it, and it's called a dwell time. And the dwell time basically just means the time you need that solution to be on a surface in order for it to be effective. So in other words, again, pre my SteriClean days, I needed to clean my counter. I took my spray, whatever it may have been, Lysol or Clorox or whatever, sprayed it, wiped it down. You read the directions, I probably should have left that sit for like 15 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, whatever the manufacturer describes, in order for that to be effective. So that's the biggest thing people need to do. Read the bottle, follow the instructions. If you do that, you pretty much should be okay, because this is also a very weak virus, meaning the makeup of it is very weak, meaning you can kill it relatively quickly. So on the EPA website, if anyone goes there, they will see a list of products and plenty of over-the-counter products that you can buy at your grocery store or drugstore that the EPA is saying will kill this virus. But again, going back to what I first said, just read the bottle and follow the directions.
And letting that product sit and do its work, do its job, instead of just wiping it right away.
Correct. Absolutely. Because again, if you think, I like to help people understand how long something can stay on a surface. If you just, as long as you didn't just wash your hands, but if you take your finger and touch even your iPad or your iPhone screen or glass, you can see your fingerprint. If you take a tissue and sort of wipe that, you now have just smeared it. You haven't cleaned it. So it sticks and it stays around, and that's why it's important. Let that product, whatever you're using, sit there and work the way it's designed to work, and then you should be okay.
And how should we approach bleach?
I love bleach, and I am a I am a bleach person. However, bleach will obviously affect different materials and different surfaces. So I would say use it as long as you're not going to be bleaching out any kind of color or the surface would be damaged by it. I use bleach in my bathtub and my sinks and my tile floors. I use it as much as I can. However, you can't use it on fabric or it's going to turn white, of course. And there are certain materials, countertops, kitchen cabinets, things like that, that you shouldn't use bleach on. But I am a proponent. If you can use it, use it. Use it safely, though. Have gloves. Understand the fumes, so you should mask up and protect your respiratory system, because it will do damage if you're not using it properly and just inhaling those fumes. But if you can use it, I would use it.
We're talking,
or dilute it. You can dilute it.
Yeah, you can. And what are the, when you dilute it, what are those proportions?
Again, I would look at the manufacturer recommendation. It does depend on what you're cleaning.
Oh, okay.
So if it's a really tough stain, or, you know, in our world, if we can use it on a crime scene cleanup and it's blood, we won't dilute it. But if it's something milder, it could probably be a 1-10 or 1-10 ratio.
We're talking with Carol Chabot, owner of SteraClean, which operates out of the Maryland, Delaware area. She's a biohazard expert. We're learning about deep cleaning and sanitizing, especially in areas where there is suspected or confirmed cases of COVID-19. Still taking your questions, 800-642-1234. Carol, what is the most important equipment that you have that may be very low tech that we could perhaps incorporate into our cleaning bucket?
Just common sense. Common sense. And I'm not suggesting people shouldn't take this seriously. We should, and everyone should. But just think in terms of common sense. And again, if I get a call from someone who says, look, my grandfather just contracted or has been tested positive, but grandpa only like lived in one room of the house, we don't need to go to the second floor and deep clean the second floor if grandpa was never up there. So just common sense. And again, just think in terms of, okay, what could be potentially affected? People sometimes forget about the simple things like car keys and car door handles, a light, the switch on a lamp. A ceiling fan pull cord. Sometimes people forget those things. They are so concentrated on door handles and sink faucets and things like that. Credit cards, you know, just think in terms of going beyond the obvious and what you're really touching in a day. If you sit and think for just a few minutes, all the places you touch, you'd probably be amazed.
What about rags and sponges? How often should those be washed?
Yeah, that's a good question. We never use sponges. Sponges is just a revolving petri dish, as far as I'm concerned. However, we do use rags. We like microfiber rags, or just a good towel kind of consistent cotton rag. The key to rags are get rid of them. Either throw them out or wash them in hot water. Bleach if you can bleach them, but get rid of them and don't overuse them. So in other words, when we clean, we're taking maybe a 1 foot square rag and we're making a quarter out of them. So we'll use on one side four different sections of rag, and once we're done, then we throw them out.
Carol, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Carol Chabot is a biohazard expert, owner of SteraClean, operating out of the Maryland, D.C. area. Her cleaning company works on jobs, including disinfecting facilities due to the pandemic. Just ahead, we look at how college campuses are addressing race. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.